If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret. Searching for the sound. This is The Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman. Subscribe to our newsletter today at thesoundpodcast.com/subscribe. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and Twitter. Now, here's Ira.
The Sound Podcast is proud to be part of the Osiris Podcasting family, a growing community of music and culture podcasts connecting music fans like you with conversation, commentary, and music. For more, visit osirispod.com. The show starts now.
Been so long since I belonged here, ever since I lost my way. That was when I still had something special left for me to say. Will unto you, just to see your smile, laugh and look at me. Held me tight in the morning, child. Been so long since I felt at home in the mirror. Was a time I'd run, skin running down the street we used to live. That was when I still had something more special left for me to give. Will unto you, oh, just to see your laugh and look at me. Will when you held me tight in the morning. Been so long since I felt at home in the mirror.
You have been listening to Been So Long by Jorma Kaukonen, taken from a performance on November 2nd, 1998 in Cincinnati, Ohio. In fact, Been So Long is the title of Jorma's recent autobiography, available now from St. Martin's Press. The memoir is filled with delicious stories from this one-time Jefferson Airplane guitarist who now, 77 years young, continues to perform with his pal Jack Cassaday in Hot Tuna, and as a solo artist. Yoram's life is fascinating, as anecdotes match the great stories of his very early days to more contemporary ones. I should mention that we recorded this interview a week before Jefferson Airplane co-founder Marty Balin's passing, so unfortunately we didn't cover his life. Our conversation started, though, when I asked Yorma what made him decide to sit down and compile this book now.
Well, it was sort of like a confluence of fortuitous events. I've been blogging off and on for a number of years, but there's a big difference. People write, there's a big difference in blogging and writing a book. So I got to talking to my wife, Vanessa, a couple of years ago, and she suggested, as a productive wife often does, that because I wrote well, it might not be a bad idea to think about writing a memoir. And I sort of like, what a great idea. And so because she does what she does for me, she's also my manager, she got in touch with St. Martin's Press, and a number of things happened, and all of a sudden we had an opportunity to make a deal. And I had to really decide, am I really going to do this? Or have I just been sort of thinking about doing it? And I decided, you know something? I'm ready to take the plunge. So she made the book deal. But my gag is, we signed the deal and we got an advance and I had to write the book. And that's, it's a funny way to look at it. But I actually decided, I not only can do this, but I think I need to do it. Not necessarily from the point of view that I need to tell my story, but that I need to be able to actually tell my story and to finish it and to say, I've done this. And so that's kind of how it started. And then when I began to write, I sort of waited until the muse, whatever that is, tickled me, and then I would write stuff. But then I realized I could be waiting for 100 years for the muse to tickle me enough to really write the whole thing. And again, a fortuitous circumstance. I was listening to Terry Gross Fresh Air on NPR, and she was interviewing some Hollywood guy whose name eludes me, but the wisdom, what he said, stuck with me. He's a guy who's like a director, and he wrote, did all the stuff like a lot of those guys do. And her question to him was basically, what stimulates you? Do you wait for the muse, et cetera, et cetera? And he said, I would never get anything done if I waited for that moment of inspiration. I make the process be my inspiration. And I heard that and I went, I like that. Mm-hmm. And so I really made the actual process of sitting down in front of my computer and starting to write be the inspiration. And one thing led to another and it worked for me and I got it done.
How long did it take? I'm just curious because you go.
It took about a year and a half, I think, maybe close to 2 years, to actually do the writing. And then there was a lot. Then after that, there was a lot of editing and stuff like that by the people that know how to do this. And I have to say, because I talk to people, they're going to emasculate you. They're this. The people that helped me with the editing after I wrote the book were absolutely instrumental in teaching me so much about writing and making it a better book. They didn't change anything. They didn't rewrite anything, but they helped me tell the story in a better way.
And it is a fascinating story. I mean, it does.
Oh, thanks.
To a certain degree, read like an American Dream. Probably
in a way,
right? But
yeah, sure.
Probably the dream that your forebears didn't see through. I mean, they obviously had some success and personal wealth and all of
sure,
those things.
Of course, yeah.
But very different from your personal success. When
right, and I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Sorry, you go ahead.
No, I mean, that's a really good point because especially for me, I'm a second generation American. So the place of immigrants in my society is very important to me, obviously. And, I guess the important thing is not what the dream is, but to have a dream. Now, this is not a discussion I had with either of my sets of grandparents, because we wouldn't have talked like that back then. And that's unfortunate, because they've been gone for a long time. And at this point, I would have liked to have known, but I'll never know, Mm-hmm. But obviously, to pull up stakes and to move across the ocean and do all this kind of stuff. Obviously something, it wasn't just like, I think I'll start a new life in a country where I can't speak the language and where immigrants are not particularly welcomed.
Right.
You know, because American immigrants have a history of not being particularly welcome, but they transcend that stuff. That's the deal. Anyway, so I guess in a way, the fact that my dream would manifest itself in being an artist that's more often than not in the public eye, as opposed to just raising a family successfully and having your kids be a success, it's the same thing. It's just a different dream.
Right, right. Was your moving to California similar in the fact that picking up stakes and moving out there and not necessarily knowing what that jam was going to be about similar in any way to your forebears?
I don't think so. I'm going to say yes or no, but first I'm going to stop by saying I don't think so because of my dad being in the Foreign Service and we traveled around so much, I was used to pulling up stakes. So it wasn't like I had a world of friends. You know, like my son, where he's grown up in Arlington, Virginia, he's in college now, and he still hangs with the same people he hung out with at kindergarten. You know, because that's how it is for him, or for people that grew up in the same neighborhood, but that's not how it was for me. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I didn't have to pull up those stakes. But in a way, I did, because when I moved to California to go to college then, other than I had that rock of being still being in college to hold on to, I had no idea what the future held in store for me.
Right. And that's a trippy line to be on, right? I mean, knowing that.
Yeah.
Right.
I think one of the things that made it not quite so, I mean, yeah, the answer is true. That's absolutely a trippy line, no question about it. But being young at the time also, you know, like my grandmother used to say, when you're young, it's good to be audacious.
Right.
I don't know if it's audacious or just too dumb to realize the consequences. I mean, who knows, you know? but it just seemed, I'm going to California. I'm going to go to school because that's what my family expected. But along the way, I'm going to put myself out there as a musician and as an artist. To me, that part of it is more trippy than fulfilling my parents' dream for me, which was to stay in college.
Right.
However, it was a confluence of events, and one couldn't have happened without the other.
That's a great name for a book. So think about that for next time.
Thank you very much. That is a great name, actually.
Or even a song. There you go. I've written or the beginning of a song for you. I'm curious about those early days with Janis. And did you realize right away that she was the talent that she was, and if she could only keep herself from herself, she would have been like an icon?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, the first time I heard Janis, which was the first week I was in California in a grubby little turning room in San Jose, I absolutely knew that I was in the presence of real serious, serious artistic greatness. Now, I had no idea about her or her life or her problems because I never saw any of these manifested in that time. And I will tell you that I've gotten to know her sister, Laura, over the years, and Laura told me that Janis was always reinventing herself and doing this and that. And the Janis that I knew was the folky, bluesy Janis, because we were friends in that time. Now, when PBS did their little girl blues special on Janis, I was interviewed for almost an hour, and I'm not in that special at all. And the reason is, and I don't feel disrespected by it, because they talked about all of her problems and her insecurities and this stuff. I never did drugs with her, and I never had sex with her. We were just musical friends. And that just did in that particular documentary. So I had no idea about any of her demons at that time, and that's just how it was. As a result, I mean, it's not like Janis and I became an item or an act and moving around. Mm-hmm. She lived in San Francisco, and I lived in San Jose. So any time that she needed to come down the peninsula, if it was from Palo Alto or below, it was easier for her to call me than some guitar player in San Francisco and get them to go down with her.
Right.
So that was great news for me because I got to play with her a number of times. And the first time I actually got a show at the Tangent, Palo Alto, by myself, I was supposed to back Janis. I went to the show. She didn't show up. And so they said, well, why don't you go on?
Hmm.
And I did, and then they hired me after that.
Amazing. And I guess, you know,
it is amazing.
It makes a better story, right, for Janice's demons to be the highlight of the story as opposed to...
Well, I mean, it doesn't. I mean, listen, you know, I'm not naive about this stuff, and I understand that tends to be, in a way, things that are more interesting. And Janice had a lot of demons. There's no question about that.
Right.
But in a way, if you think about it, if you think about the purity of the love of the art in the light of the way things evolve for all of us, that really is the better story to me anyway.
Right. And the other icon that, you know, you don't get mentioned with a lot, but you did live parallel lives for, you know, that 7-year period. Is Jerry. And
absolutely, sure.
And, you know, there are stories whether you were competitive or, but you did live, you were these guitar icons in that era of psych rock.
Right.
But you were never necessarily seen together unless you were on stage together, and you didn't necessarily befriend one another. You were kind of these two separate guitar icons. What was your relationship with? Let's get it on the record.
Know, I mean, after all the standing down, Jerry and I, we were friends. And when I was writing the book, the folks at St. Martin's Press, of course, they wanted more stories about Jerry and Janice. And I had to point them out. Listen, I loved and respected them as people, as artists, but I wasn't a fan in the fan sense. And you know what I mean by uh-huh. I didn't like them or anything.
Right.
I wasn't, you know what I mean. Yeah. Anyway, so we were colleagues.
Right.
But Jerry was a really great guy. You know, he was already firmly established when I showed up in the fall of 1962. And all of us artists are competitive on some level, but it's not a swinging dick kind of thing. It's just that we always want to do our best, you know. And he always welcomed me into the world where he was. And that welcome, I think we did one gig together at the offstage. Other than that, we went to each other's gigs. A lot of times we played the same kind of festival-y things. And so we were an active part of the same world. But I was primarily a blues player more than anything else, and a gospel player. And Jerry had a lot of irons in the fire, whether it was bluegrass or Mother McCree's Uptown Jug Stompers or the Warlocks, which became the Grateful Dead. He always had other irons in the fire.
Mm-hmm.
So we were both pretty busy with whatever our, you know, nascent career was. But he was always very, not only was he welcoming, you know, to me as a stranger when I came there in 62, but as the rock and roll thing began to evolve, and I got into the Jefferson Airplane, the Grateful Dead was already together by that time,
mm-hmm.
And I got into the airplane, I went to him because I knew there were things that he knew, having been a long-time band leader and a participant where he'd play with a bunch of guys and they made music, that he would be able to give me advice. And he gave me some sound advice, none of it which had to do really with notes on the guitar, but rather with philosophical approach.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things he told me, other people have said this too, but I remember him saying it, it's what you don't play that matters, play in the holes, because we were talking about being lead guitar players,
mm-hmm.
and remember it's always about the song.
Right. Right. But you both, and in different ways, you know, had this huge love of roots music, and you know, yours was blues.
Absolutely, oh, totally.
Yours was blues and bluegrass, and his was more bluegrass than anything else. I mean,
right?
He never wanted to pick up. He claimed he never was going to pick up an electric guitar, but that changed. But
right, I'm sure we all claimed that at least once.
Right. But the two of you created this genre, probably accidentally, not on purpose, and probably not knowing that you were creating this psych rock thing. But you're both bands are credited for doing that in different ways, I guess.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of Jerry stories, but I'm glad. I mean, the setting that you just set up for me is perfect for one of the few Jerry stories that I have, and it's absolutely true. The Grateful Dead lived in this sort of commune kind of thing in a little town called Olam Pali, in north of San Francisco. And I don't know what it was before they moved into it, but they had a swimming pool and a bunch of stuff. Anyway, so it was Jerry and Janice and Jack Cassidy and myself. For some reason, we were all there at the same time sitting around the pool. And Janice, you know, Jack never really saw himself as a roots musician. You know, he was much more intellectual about his approach to music than I was. And Janice and I were having this discussion about how long do we have to be on this earth as artists before people will take us as seriously as, let's say, Fred McDowell or Mississippi John Hurt. Mm-hmm. And I remember like it was yesterday, Jerry raised his hand, he looked at us, and he says, "We're going to be archetypes." And I remember thinking at the time, yeah, sure we are. But in an odd way, it came to pass.
Right. Which, again, is ironic because I don't think Jerry ever wanted to be an archetype. I think it just kind of...
I don't think he did either, you know. And, just before you move on with your line of questioning, a couple of years ago, it was an honor for me to be a part of a thing called Dear Jerry, a big production of Meriwether Post where they had a lot of guys and we played Jerry songs and stuff like that. Anyway, they had an interview thing where they questioned all the artists who were there, and the question was, if you could write a letter to Jerry Garcia right now, what would you say? And I said, I'll bet you wish you were here.
Right. Right. Yep. Too true. I have these questions that come up as themes from the book that I'd love to ask you about.
Sure, sure.
The first one is, you have, you know, two very base passions, and that is mechanics of cars,
yes,
and bikes, but also, yes, mechanics of guitars and amps, sure, and all of your musical devices. I'm curious, yeah, what the parallel in your mind is between the two, and is it just that you just have a mind for these things, or is there something deeper than that?
Well, I think that's a good question. And when I look at it, sitting here in my Jeep Wrangler with the rain on the roof, which is moderately new, so I don't have to fix it. But I think the metaphor is freedom. I mean, for me as a kid, when I was able to interact with things that had engines on them, and, you know, whether it was a motorcycle or a car, that was an incredible liberating thing in a way that it is not for my young children who are starting to drive. They don't, it's not like, wow, you know, I could, if I had the time and the money, I could go to California. They don't, it's not like that. They right, go, I'm going to school or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. And music, in a way, also absolutely transcended whatever dissatisfactions I had with my space on the planet as a human being. Now, I didn't think about it like that back then, because, yeah, I mean, you know, you're a kid, you just do what you do and you find things you like. But I think that the playing of music allowed me to move into a parallel universe in that process, and being able to drive vehicles did the same thing. Now, back in those days, to get a vehicle, you took what you could got, what you got. I mean, it's like I'm saying, I'm driving a car that's a couple of years old. The warranty's still good on it, you know. Back in then, you had to learn how to fix stuff, because if you didn't, it didn't run. So I think I got into mechanics of vehicles largely through Jack's older brother, Chick, because he was a superb mechanic.
Right.
I mean, I needed to do it, but I liked it also. And I like stuff, you know. I still have the same set of socket wrenches I got when I was like 16 years old. I mean, they're a little tarnished, but they'll last forever, you know. And I just kind of like that stuff. And I think I felt the same way about guitars and amplifiers. You kind of needed to maintain them on your own. I mean, I couldn't do like major surgery, but if I needed to set the bias on a tube or change tubes or adjust bridges, you know, you learn how to do that stuff. And I never found it to be a drag to do that. I always found it to be sort of contemplative. And when you get it right, you just feel good about yourself.
So the next question is, how different is that experience from writing a song?
Okay. I think it's a big difference. I think in a major way, because when you're dealing with tangibles like mechanics, there are very definitely right and wrong things that can happen in the process. Songs are so forgiving on so many levels. I mean, you never know what is going to turn a bunch of words into a great song. Right. Songs are not like poetry. Good poetry doesn't necessarily make good songs. The reverse is also true. So to me, because songs are a way to say something to somebody you don't know, hopefully you'll find an artful way to do this. Now, one of the things that I've learned over the years, in the beginning, with many of them, but not with all songs, but with many songs, you're actually saying something. And if one of the people that liked one of my tunes didn't hear or get what I was saying, in the past, I would be like, "You mean that's what you think? You didn't get what I'm saying?" My feelings would be hurt.
Right. You know?
But that's not the case anymore. I've readjusted my whole outlook on that stuff in a more realistic way. If somebody likes what I'm doing and what I'm saying, that's good enough for me. If we get to know each other and we have a conversation, I'll be interested in what he thought, and I'll tell him what I thought. But anyway, to get back to that mechanical question of it, you know, you just can't put boundaries on music. And so to be able to get into that emotional moment and follow it to its conclusion is a lot more forgiving on some levels than doing a valve job on a motorcycle.
Right, right. And would you say that writing instrumental music is a similar thing in that it's the parallel I was trying to mention here is that it's
yeah.
freeing and liberating, not necessarily
sure.
the tactile thing of fixing a
yeah,
car
yeah, okay.
versus writing a song,
right, right, okay.
but more the inspiration to be freeing and to free your mind or free yourself from whatever it is that you're doing. I mean,
I think that for myself as a writer, whether it's instrumental or lyrical, that event, that freeing catharsis mm-hmm. doesn't really happen until the project is done, and then you realize that that is what happened. Now, when I use the term write loosely, when I write instrumental stuff, because I'm not a composer in that I sit down and write on a piece of paper, the guitar always tells me what to do. And I, as a rule, I'll sit down and start playing something, and something about that activity, maybe a lick, maybe a chord change, something, I'll stumble on something that just tells me this needs to go somewhere. And over the years, I've become aware of this, and I try to take advantage of it, not all the time. I try to take advantage of what happens, because if I don't, that moment's gone.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so I'll start chasing sounds or chords or a lick or something like that on the guitar. And if it's something I like, I'll try to repeat it so I can remember it. And if I'm really being proactive, I'll pick my phone up and record it.
Right. And are you always, well, not always, because obviously you're playing and you're doing other things, but are you thinking
right.
about music? Are you thinking about, or do you have to sit yourself down to come up with licks and chords and stuff? Or...
Music, like so many of us, music is a huge part of my life, and I listen to it all the time. I don't think I think about it all the time in terms of how it plays in my life as an artist or a career or something like that. Sometimes I do, but not all the time. I mean, like, you know, I'm driving around in my car today, and of course I've got who knows how many songs on my iPhone. I'm just picking up some stuff that just stumble on. Well, like, for example, there's a rhythm and blues song from the, I forget when it's from, like the 80s or something like that. I don't remember. Anyway, a rhythm blues singer named James Carter called The Dark End of the Street.
Mm-hmm.
I heard it as a credit roll on that Stars series called The Counterpart. And I heard that song. Now, all my friends have heard the song dubbed by the Flying Burrito Bros, by all these different, I must have lived under a rock because I never heard it before. But I heard the song, and there's just something about it, and I just, before you called, I just listened to it five times in a row, and I loved every time.
Right.
So I'm always doing something with music, not necessarily mine, but always some kind of music.
And so for your own music, you have to take the time to sit down and...
Yeah, that's a little bit different.
Yeah.
I'm not fond of listening to myself in the same way that I would listen to the James Carr song.
Right.
But when I play, if I'm going, I tend to be deadline driven also. There's sometimes life will kick me in the ass and you'll write a song. But you could be waiting a long time for that to happen. So if I have a project and I need to write songs, I'll go, okay, now I need to take the advice that I give songwriting students. I need to take my guitar. I need to sit next to the piano. I'm not a piano player, but sometimes I use it to find chord shapes and stuff.
Right.
And it was my pen and paper, because I like writing songs with a pencil and paper, and then I'll put it on a word processor.
Wow.
And I'm going to sit down, and I'm going to write a song. And I'll try to find a line. I'm going to write a song about, a disaffected marriage or a parallel universe. I'll sit down, and I'll just let some words dance through my head, and if I get a line that I like, I will write that line down. I'm go, okay, here's where we're going to start. And whether it turns out to be a good song or not, I'm not going to stop until it's done.
Right. And then do you know when it's done? Obviously, you know when. Like, how much tweaking?
Yeah, most of the time. One of the things that I tend to find I oftentimes write too many verses to songs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not every song needs to be like Bob Dylan's Boots of Spanish Leather, which could be a volume in itself.
Right.
That's a long song. but yeah, I mean, and I've gotten over the thing where my words are like children. I can't let them be orphans. I'm over that,
Right.
So normally I'll find I'll probably have to cut two or three verses, and that's just how it is.
The loyalty to Jack.
Yes.
That's deeper than kinship and musicianship. Are you his big...
Absolutely.
Are you his big brother? Are you to Jack what Pete wasn't necessarily to you?
Well, here's the thing. In an odd way, Jack is younger than me. But
sorry,
in
the
an
other
odd way.
I
get what you're saying.
Yeah.
In an odd way, he's a big brother to me in a lot of ways. I don't think he would even know this. And now that we've had this, I'm going to see him tomorrow. I'm going to mention this to him because in terms of us stepping out into the world as musicians, he's the one that had the drive to do that.
Right.
Because since he played in bands, he was used to dealing with a world that I wasn't used to dealing with, which is playing with a bunch of other people, having a common goal, getting things done, getting gigs, showing up at the gigs and stuff like that. He was a professional musician in a way that I, even when I was making money as a solo folk musician, it's not the same thing. So his ability to identify goals and seek them was far greater than mine. My ability to seek goals was really limited to just getting better with what I was doing and playing more and getting a gig once a week and showing up. I mean, he saw music as a quote-unquote career before I could spell the word career. And so, and that's the way it is. I mean, I don't know why he is like that. I don't know why. He was from an upper middle class family. He didn't have to struggle, but he defined goals in his life in a much more concrete way, far earlier than I did, and I was able to ride on his coattails. That was a huge help to me, no question about it.
And is that why was that safety net and his sort of left? No, he would be more right brain probably. Was that what? Really, consciously or otherwise, made you invite him out to California? I mean, you could find the bass player. Let's be honest. But you specifically invited Jack out, and you specifically wanted him to be part of the band.
When we were looking for a bass player, Jack and I, in addition to being musical compatriots, we were always really good friends. You know, sometimes we'd go to movies together. You know, we read books. I mean, so we had a deep friendship that was very profound, even when we hadn't seen each other for a couple of years. Because when I called him, I hadn't seen him for like, I don't know, a year and a half, 2 years, something like that. And, you know, we didn't have cell phones back then. Right. So getting in touch with him meant I had to call him when he was home, or I had to call him when I had a phone.
Right.
But I knew in a way that I can't really adequately put into words that he was the right guy to play with the band. Now, there's another factor also. Even though I lived in California for, you know, almost 2 years by the time the band got together, I was not a Californian yet. And I think it made me feel comfortable to get one of my guys, one of my homeboys, involved on the project so we would have an East Coast presence, for lack of a better way to put it, you know. And I just knew Jack was going to be great, you know, because that was what he put out there, and he was great. And is great.
Yeah, absolutely. Because time is not necessarily our friend, I'm curious about...
not always.
the Yorma legacy. And, you know, Airplane was such a big deal, but...
Yeah.
I mean, that star faded. Tuna has the longevity of... basically you and Jack's relationship. I mean, the bands that you had before
sure.
Jack moved out could have easily been called Hot Tuna, given that...
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah. Well, just given the idea of that, it's the name for the duo or group known as Jack and Yorma. Is the legacy Tuna, Airplane, the canon of music that you've written for both? Or is it ultimately, you know, the work that you're doing at the Fur Peace Ranch Guitar Camp?
Well, you know, this is a question I get asked periodically, and my off the top of the head answer is my legacy for me rests in my relationship with my children above everything, and that I've been able to turn a lot of people on to Reverend Gary Davis and Roots Music.
Right.
After that, you know, with this, especially with the Fur Peace Ranch, we just had a session. My ability to pass on what I know and give people an opportunity to take what they want from that, I truly enjoy doing that. I really do. And the people that come and teach for us enjoy doing that also. So I guess Vanessa's, my place in all this is offering a venue where this transfer of somewhat arcane information, because it's not like going to Berklee School of Music, we're learning music theory and stuff like that, and I don't trivialize that, but it's much more sociable. The sociable answer is, why do we love this? Why does that look so cool? You know, why do I want to do this? Why do I want to do that? And having doors open for people to try to find answers to those questions, that's also important to me.
It's interesting yet again, because in many ways, you're describing your version of Judaism, opening doors and being inspired and why and all of those sorts of very similar things.
Tikkun Olam, perhaps. Who knows, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's a good point, too, because even though I wasn't raised in a very secular Jewish family, still it was a very Jewish family. And since you've made me think about this, that was everywhere. That mindset was everywhere.
Right. How's that been? I mean, Vanessa converted 12, 13 years ago now?
Yeah, right, exactly, yeah.
And it's...
I just went to High Hall. I sat through a very long service at Yom Kippur.
Is it still exciting for you? I mean, is it still exciting for her? You have to make her a bat mitzvah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
She was, this is really funny because she was meant to be Jewish. My friend David Wolf, who's my partner in Breakdown Way, is Jewish also. And we were in Athens, Ohio before she converted. And we went to this restaurant. We were going to take her out to dinner. We got a table. And And it was a little bit cramped, but we got the table, you know. And she comes in and she looks down at the table. She goes, "Oh, no, no, that won't do it." She changed tables. And David said, "I've never seen a non-Jewish woman do that before." So when she confirmed, I mean, she was meant to be Jewish. There's just no question about it.
It's pretty clear from that story when you went to the West Virginia shul she was more than excited to be part of.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, she was moved to tears.
Yeah, exactly. Right, as that's the story.
And because I'm sort of a wise guy, when the guy who greeted us, who was wearing cowboy boots and a cowboy hat, said, "Shalom, y'all," I just loved it.
There was a line in the book, it was actually your words that uttered it, and it spoke to me as somebody who is a fairly secular Jew, though grew up going to day school and whatever else, but I consider myself fairly secular. There was something about wrapping yourself in a tallit and understanding that, I forget the exact phrasing that you put, but that it was the comfort of knowing that you were safe or home, or there was a specific way you
absolutely
said it. Yeah.
Absolutely. Now, my friend Barry Minaroff, who played mandolin for years, his dad, may rest in peace, used to say, if there's three Jews in a neighborhood, two synagogues is not enough. Mm-hmm. And having been involved in the Jewish community for a number of years now, I totally get that. And it's part of the charm of the whole thing. But there are these moments for somebody like me who is a, quote-unquote, as my rabbi friend said, a non-professional Jew, when you put on tefillin, or, you know, you put your kiffi on, or your tallit or stuff, it just feels right, you know?
Uh-huh.
And if you weren't a Jew, you wouldn't feel that way.
Right. Right. Yes, but you also put peanut butter on your bagel before you put Nova.
I do.
Nova.
Because that's hillbilly cream. That's hillbilly cream cheese.
I can't thank you enough for your time, for all that you do, all that you've done. My final question is, what musicians impress you today and carry on the legacy that Jack and yourself and Janice and Jerry and Paul?
And I think, you know, I tend to listen to singer-songwriters more than anybody else because I'm more moved by words these days than by playing.
Right.
But I'm going to talk about a guy that's been a that's helped me with my classes because he also reads and writes music and tab. He's a young guy named Tom Feldman. He just turned 40. He's from north of Minneapolis, Minnesota. And he's somebody that, because he doesn't tour anymore because he's got a wife and kids and stuff, he is just a brilliant Delta blues musician on every level. Mm-hmm. Writes great songs that are more than Delta blues. I mean, he's a guy that I listen to and I go, this is where the music that I love can take you. Because he is one of the living masters of the traditional Delta blues, but when he reads or when he writes stuff of his own, he uses those tools, but it's absolutely his own. So Tom Feldman, that's Feldman with two N's at the end, is well worth looking into. Mm-hmm. I also, like I said, I really like singer-songwriters. I got turned on to this guy named Sean Rowe. Mm-hmm. I heard him, he did a song as a credit role for the end of that Ben Affleck movie, The Accountant, called Something to Leave Behind. And I liked it. I Shazammed it, of course, and boom, there it was. I bought the album, and he's... He just really writes. He's not a blues guy. Nothing sounds even vaguely bluesy, but I love his music. I like Gretchen Peters, great Nashville singer-songwriter. Her productions are very slick because her husband's a studio guy, but her lyrics are so from the heart. You need to check out an album called Dancing with the Beast. And every song on that is like an arrow through the heart.
Wow. And is there more Yorma music coming in the future?
There is. We've been thinking about doing another Hot Tuna electric album, and I just got texted a couple of days ago by Dave Schools from Widespread Panic mm-hmm. that wants to produce the record. And if, when I get enough electric songs written, I think he's the guy to do it because he understands what it is that we do in that incarnation.
Yeah.
So far I haven't even talked to him. In fact, I'm going to call him later today. I haven't even talked to him. I barely mentioned it to Jack, but I'm starting to get excited about these possibilities.
So cool. Thanks, Yorma. Really appreciate your time. And
have fun on tour. I'm glad we made it happen.
Have fun
yeah,
on
man,
tour.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Be well. Cheers.
Done.
Thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Honestly, Yorma would have chatted forever. We probably could have gone through his entire memoir story by story, but then you wouldn't buy the book, or better yet, listen to the audiobook, which he voices himself. I can tell you that he was exuberant to talk about his book and story even before we started to record. You can learn more about Yorma at his website, which also houses his blog, at yormakalkinen.com. Before we leave you, have a listen to this Hot Tuna take on the Sunhouse classic Walkin' Blues, taken from a Hot Tuna performance at the Capitol Theater in Port Chester, New York, December 8th, 2017.
Thank you. shoes. God knows I got them, baby. Them on walking through the desert. Feel proud for my shoes.
You've been listening to the Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. Subscribe to our newsletter today at thesoundpodcast.com/subscribe. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and Twitter. The Sound Podcast is part of the Osiris Network. For more, visit osirispod.com. Thanks for listening.
Osiris.